Okay, folks, let's get to no announcements today. Okay, I'm going to start with my two standard questions. Until I have no hands going up, I have to keep asking these questions. The first is, who's not in a group yet? Everybody's in a group? Or are you just afraid to put your hand up? Okay, this is good. I don't have to ask this question anymore. Who doesn't have a company yet? Come on, be honest. You don't have a company? You're one of the few honest people. Find one. There are 41,989 companies waiting for you. One of them will fit you, okay? Pick a damn company. Let's get moving, okay? And finally, what was your favorite Super Bowl ad? I'll tell you what mine was. It shows you how juvenile I am. That puppy, monkey, baby. That's the only one I remember from the whole Super Bowl, actually. You know? Anyway. Okay, good. Thank you. So let's pick up where we left off Wednesday. It feels like so long ago. But we were talking about what the biggest plus of the market-based system is, which is it corrects itself. And I talked about what happens when managers overreach. Right? That piss-off factor, the threshold you reach, you get activist investors, you get hostile acquisitions, and the game starts to change. Let's talk about the second linkage. Remember the Nabisco effect where people lend money to Nabisco and then they got ripped off? You know what happened post-Nabisco? People learned. Learned in what way? Post-Nabisco, a lot of corporate bonds had put clauses. What are put clauses? They were puttable bonds. It allowed people who bought the bonds to put the bond back to the company and saying, you change the rules of the game, I'd like my $1,000 back, the face value of the bond. So if you'd had this with the Nabisco bond, you could have gone to Nabisco and said, you guys did an LBO. That wasn't what I signed up for. I want my money back. A lot more bonds were convertible bonds. Why? Because people start to rip you off, you become one of them, the equity investors. Again, too late to protect you on the Nabisco bond, but maybe on the next bond issue. Yes? No. You get to keep the coupon. So if the question was, in a puttable bond, do you have to give back what you already got in the bond? No, the rules are, as long as you hold the bond like a regular bond, you get the coupons. It's up to the company. If they change the rules of the game, you say, look, you know, you've changed the rules. I'd like my principal back. I'll go invest it somewhere else. Again, too late to protect you on the Nabisco bond, but people learned and adapted for the next bond issue. That's the market correction. And finally, we talked about markets lying to markets, right? Holding back information. Let's start with the lying. What happens if you lie to markets? Does the truth eventually come out? It always does. The question is when. When it does come out, what's the first thing that happens? Your stock price collapses, naturally. And then it stays down. You know why? Because you've lost all credibility. You're saying, so what? I'm going to say something that's going to sound odd, but hang in there anyway. I can understand why a mature company might commit accounting fraud. I'm not condoning it, but I can understand it. I cannot understand a young growth company committing accounting fraud. Do you see why? Where does the bulk of your value come from as a growth company? It comes from growth assets. What drives the value of growth assets? Perceptions and expectations. Driven by what? By people believing you when you say, I'm going to do this, this, and this. You go lie. And this is why I never understood the Groupon game. For those of you who track Groupon, it became public about 3 years ago with a lot of fanfare. Run by a guy called Andrew Malcolm, big ego. And one of the things they did was they played accounting game after accounting game. Things like, we really made money, we didn't lose money. Don't trust your eyes, we really made money. And what they did was they said that a big chunk of their expenses were customer acquisition costs, which is technically true. All those emails they sent you to harass you about Groupon deals, a customer acquisition cost. And they said, we shouldn't be expensing it. We should be treating it as a CapEx. So really, we have no expenses. Okay? No harm trying, I guess. But the problem is, you keep playing these games. People, after a while, are going to say, why should I trust you about anything else you say? So the so when you lie, not only does your price drop, it stays down. What happens if you hold back the truth? Remember we talked about not quite lying, errors of omission, delaying information? You know that Volkswagen has delayed its earnings report for about 4 weeks? Why? Because they have all this stuff to work through. And during the 4 weeks, I can almost predict what's going to happen. When you delay revealing something, what does the market assume? You're holding back. Good news or bad news? Yes. So what you start seeing when markets hold back is the market starts dropping. You mean it's not fair, but that's the way markets have to work. So markets have these strange mechanisms for dealing with liars. And over time, you're going to pay a much bigger cost as a result of doing that than you might not have. Which brings me to the social cost. Do you guys watch this guy, Martin Tricelli, in front of Congress? You've heard of him, right? So he's a little, I think he's a little off, to be quite honest. He looks like a really bright guy, but there's something a little off. And the reason I know is somebody emailed me this YouTube video. He makes these dozens and dozens, where he's going through my website, clicking on things and talking. He said, do you condone this? I said, he clicks my website. What does it mean whether do I condone it? You can click my website as much as you want. But for those of you who followed this phenomenon, he, of course, bought the rights to a drug and he hiked the price up 700-fold. Legally, he was actually on fair ground. And he said, my job is to maximize stock prices. That's why I'm doing this. And my reaction was, you're missing the point here. Missing the point in what sense? By increasing the price, is he going to make more money this year? Absolutely, if he's going to make more money. But if you get tarred as a company that's beyond the bounds, company that doesn't play by the rules, you know what's going to happen next, right? It's going to be tough for you to find people to work for you. It's going to be tough for you if you have to. Remember, you're in the business. The healthcare business is one of the most regulated and government-run of all the businesses you're in because Medicare accounts, and Medicare and Medicaid account for half of all spending. So if you piss off the government too much, you might make a lot of money on this one drug by hiking the price, but you're going to destroy any chance you have of a going concern. Don't mistake increasing profits this year for maximizing value. It might or might not work, but I think that's something to factor in. There is a benefit to being on the right side of perception when it comes to, are you a good corporate citizen? Because if you go across the line, you can remember what happened to tobacco companies. For 20 years, they were viewed as bad corporate citizens. And then you could see what happened. Whenever you had to raise taxes, guess what you raised taxes on? Cigarettes and cigarette companies. And nobody came to their defense. Okay. Same thing happened with BP after the oil spill. When people targeted them, people said, I'm not defending BP. They're beyond the pale. So there is a price you're going to pay, even if something is legal, if you do something that tars you as a bad corporate citizen. So that's the blowback you get from society, is people might stop buying your products. Employees might not come to work for you. Your business might go under, even though what you might have done originally was legal. In fact, I have a blog post in Valiant, which actually is a lesser version of Turing. They did some of the same things, not to the extent that Martin Tricelli did, but they raised prices, you know, 10-fold, 20-fold on drugs that were essential. And they said, that's our business model. But it's a business model that becomes very difficult to defend, even though it might be legal, because it's not a business model that other people look and say, that's okay. That's just being a business. So here's the counter-reaction captured in one page. If managers take advantage of stockholders, at some point in time you get that blowback. Activist investing, and hostile acquisitions. If lenders are ripped off as they were in the Nabisco case, you get protections, covenants, you get new types of bonds designed to protect yourself against the last mistake. When managers mislead markets or they lie, the market reaction is swift. And it might be permanent. You might not be able to come back from it. And finally, if you violate that corporate good citizen constraint, you might bear a cost in terms of lost revenues, lost earnings, and lost value. So what you gain from this one-time profit might actually be washed out very quickly by what happens afterwards. So here's what I'd like you to think about. I've tried to sell you on, so you can kind of see where I'm coming from, what my biases are. But I like you to think about where you are right now. So don't, you don't have to tell me what you pick, but I've given a series of objectives for different for businesses. I want to tack on to whichever objective right now you're comfortable with as the objective for a business. So let me read them out. Maximize stock price with no constraints. As I said, no show of hands. You can make your decision as you go along. Maximize stock price with constraints on being a good corporate citizen. Maximize stockholder wealth. Do you see the little subtle difference? What's the difference between maximizing stock price and maximizing stockholder wealth? Stock price comes from what the market tells me I'm worth. Stockholder wealth comes from doing the right thing and saying my value is driven by cash flows. And that's, in fact, the basis for the last weekly challenge where I said, look at that letter that Lawrence Fink said. The price might not be the best indicator. So there's a subtle difference, but maximizing stockholder wealth with good citizen constraints and hope and pray the market catches up with you. Why? Because you could do the right thing, but if your price keeps going down and down and down, you're going to get fired. You might feel really good about the way you ran the company before you got fired, but it's small consolation. Maybe you don't like this price or value thing. Maybe you think it's better to maximize profits, in which case you should call Martin and set up a joint corporation. Maximize earnings growth. Maximize market share. Maximize revenues. Maximize social good. Or you haven't decided yet, which is perfectly okay. But you have to decide at some point in time. You cannot run a business with muddled objectives. That's my only message from this, is you have to pick an objective. Do you think nonprofits have to have objectives too? Absolutely. In fact, I think one of the biggest problems that I see in nonprofits is muddled objectives or these fuzzy objectives. I'll give you an example. My wife works with a group that helps the homeless. They, you know, it's called Bridges. It's a New Jersey-based. You know, they go to Newark and they go to Newark Penn Station and they go to Brooklyn Bridge, and they, you know, hand out lunch, food, and clothes. So she's on the board of directors, and they were writing their mission statement, which are nonprofits. So I said, what's your mission? And this, and she said, they're planning to make it to help the homeless. And I said, this is not good. You see why? To help the homeless is too fuzzy. Why? Because you have limited resources. They're a small, you know, charity. They have probably $600,000 overall to spend. Helping the homeless could be anywhere from buying one apartment for $600,000 and putting four people up, or helping 5,000 people with lunches every day. And you say, which one should I pick? You need more focus. Which is, you might decide that your job is to help the homeless get through the day-to-day, in which case you can say, I can't buy an apartment. That's not my mission. But that's what I mean about having a mission. It doesn't matter whether you're a nonprofit or a for-profit, a corporation or a private business. You need to have focus to be able to make decisions, because without focus, you'll be going back and forth between different decision rules. Any questions about the objective function in corporate finance? Okay. So now we're going to start in the meat and potatoes part of corporate finance. Up till now, notice I haven't spoken about a single number, no ratios yet, and some of you are saying, this is good. I didn't have to buy that financial calculator. Maybe I should sell it back right away. Don't be in such a hurry, because now we're going to start digging into the numbers. Yes. Well, I kind of gave it away, right? The question is, what's my personal opinion? I want you to maximize value and try to convince the markets that the value is right. Okay. So it'll be C. It won't even be C. It'll be even more expensive. Maximize the value of the business. Maybe stockholder in the process, stockholder wealth will actually come into play. But it's closest to C, because I'm saying do the right thing, maximize value, but you also have the responsibility of trying to tell markets what you're doing. They're not mind readers. And a lot of managers seem to think, if I do the right thing, markets would somehow magically discover I'm doing the right thing and give me a higher price. You have to go out and explain to markets what you're doing and give them a chance to respond. And that means being transparent about what you're doing and describing what you're doing. Okay? So the objective function, as I would list it, basically, so this page, in a sense, gives you my sense of what the objective should be. For publicly traded firms in reasonably efficient markets, I'm not one of these people, perfectly efficient markets, I'm never going to find. I say go out and maximize stock price, and bondholders are protected. Maximize stock price, you're going to be okay. for publicly traded firms in inefficient markets, and you can put your description of what inefficient means. Price can be different from value. Where bondholders are protected, maximize stockholder wealth. Where bondholders are not fully protected, maybe because their banks or bondholders buy bonds and they don't put in covenants, I'd prefer you maximize value, not rip off your bondholders, because that's not good for society overall. That's the way you're creating value. And for private firms, because you don't have stock prices, that option is off the table. You have to focus on some version of value, either stockholder value or business value. So if you ask me where I stand, this is where I stand. It's not going to be one answer forever. So if a Polish company called me and said, look, you know, should we be focusing on the stock price and the Warsaw Stock Exchange? I'd say, are you crazy? Because that market is illiquid, it's thin, I don't know what drives prices. I wanted to focus on value and try to convince the market that your value is the right value. So let's start on the first piece of corporate finance where we really start talking about detail. We're going to talk about risk and hurdle rates. So this is going to take us through almost midway through the semester. So it's going to be a long, long discussion. So remember this page number, because about 121 pages from now, I'm going to get to the end and say, do you remember where we started? And you're going to say, I have no idea. So write this number down. So slide 65 or whatever it is, 67, is going to be the start of the hurdle rate part of the discussion. So let me go back and review the sub-principle that we're going to focus on. The hurdle rate should reflect the riskiness of the investment that you're taking and should reflect where you get your money, debt or equity. So that's what I'm going to try to get over the next 120 slides, is what that hurdle rate is. So to do this, I need to specify what I mean by a hurdle rate. And I'm sorry, what I mean by a hurdle rate. So let me back up and at least set the table. The hurdle rate is what you need to make on an investment, not even to be happy, just to break even. So hurdle rate is my threshold for taking an investment. And the way I'm going to build up to it is I'm going to start with a base and say, what would you make if you invested in a guaranteed investment, a risk-free investment? You see why I need to start with that? Because without that, I have nothing to build on. So you need to tell me, is that going to be 2? Is it going to be 3? Is it going to be 5? So we're going to talk about that base. And then on top of that, I'm going to add a risk premium. And that risk premium is going to be a function of how risky your investment is. So the entire process is going to boil down to getting those two numbers. What is the risk-free base on which I want to build? What is that risk premium? And in order to do that, there are two questions I need to answer. The first is, I need to define risk. In fact, I'm going to make you define risk, because without a definition of risk, we're kind of out there trying to find something we can't even define. And second, once you've defined risk and measured it, I'm going to say, what kind of hurdle rate goes with that risk measure? I need to be specific. I can't tell you fuzzy things like, if it's riskier, take a higher hurdle rate. How does that help you? How much higher? 7% higher? 17% higher? So those two questions are going to drive much of what we do for the next few sessions. So let's start with that first question. Don't look at the next page, because that's cheating. But I'm going to ask you a very generic question. You've taken foundations, you've taken all these classes already, you're in the second year, the third year, the fourth year, whatever year you're in this program. You had time to accumulate stuff, you've paid a lot for whatever you've accumulated. So let's see if it pays off. I want your definition of risk. What is risk? Come on, you can do this. What is risk? Not getting your money back. Okay, that's a good start. So in a sense, you first, that already tells me that you defined risk as a bad thing, right? Not getting your money back. But does it matter whether you not get 10% back, 50% back, 80% back? So not getting your money back is a start. You're also saying not getting how much of your money back. So the more you tend to lose. So that's one way to think about risk, is in terms of downside, in terms of what percentage of what I invest could I end up losing on this investment. My son yesterday, he's 23, so I can't stop him from doing stupid stuff like this. Bet $500 on the wrong team. He was watching the Super Bowl. Towards the end, he was ready to throw up. He's not getting the 500 back, so 100% gone. So one way to think about risk is, what is the most I can lose on this investment? Uncertainty about outcome. I'll tell you why I don't like that definition, because I've replaced one fuzzy term with another fuzzy term, right? Risk, uncertainty. So I ask you, what's uncertainty? You say it's risk. What's risk? Uncertainty. So we jump in. Okay, so you're saying it could be that the actual numbers could be very different from what you expected in both directions or just... So your actual is always equal to the expected. So if your actual is, so basically I'm trying to put it in intuitive terms. You're saying if your actual numbers can be very different from your expected, it's risk. If it's, is it in both directions? So in fact, I want to boil it because this I think is going to go to the key of how we think about risk. If you got an actual outcome that was much higher than your expected outcome, would you still call it risky? That, I think, is going to go to the heart of how we start to think about risk. Because, let's face it, most of us, and this is human nature, when we think about risk, think about downside. How many people complain that their stock is risky because it went up eightfold? You say, oh my God, my stock is so risky, it went up eight times. All of a sudden, they discover risk only when they lose money. So for better or worse, even though statistically you can argue that uncertainty cuts in both ways, the reality is, none of us is afraid of upside risk. It's downside that we worry about, which might be a potential problem because it might skew the way we think about risk. Somebody back there had their hands up. Yes. See, but a profit can be a guaranteed profit, right? So for instance, you invest in a T-bond, I guarantee you a profit. It's going to be 2% every year. So the profit part has to be, you have to give some flesh to the profit part as to how much. So you want a higher profit in return for? Exactly, more uncertainty. So you're saying this is a trade-off. Is if I want to go for the higher profit, I have to live with more uncertainty. Yes? See, this is what happens after you take a finance class. And I'm not saying it's your fault. Because after you take a finance class, you know what happens? We imprint a statistical definition of risk into your... Ask people, what's risk? Standard deviation, volatility. And if you're truly brainwashed, you start saying things like beta. Right? That's when I know that you've been completely brainwashed. So I'm going to, and I think this is one of the problems we have in finance, is we've replaced risk with a number. 23%. I mean, who in their right mind, if I ask you how much risk do you want to take, how many people say 27% standard deviation? I've never met somebody who can actually translate that. So I'm going to give you my favorite definition of risk, and it's actually several thousand years old. It's a Chinese symbol for crisis. Now, I'm going to cover myself fully here. I know no Chinese. I don't want to know any Chinese. And this could be a gigantic hoax pulled on me for all I know. This could be something obscene. So I've been told that this is the Chinese symbol for risk. In fact, I'm sick and tired of the symbol because every time I put it up, I get somebody Chinese saying, this is not the Chinese symbol. I've changed it like six times in response to people saying, that's not the symbol. I think the Chinese need to talk to each other about their own symbols. And maybe it's simplified Chinese versus non-simplified Chinese versus complex Chinese versus whatever Chinese. So I'm going to stay with this definition for the moment. It's a Chinese symbol for crisis. And the Chinese symbol for crisis, or big risk, is a combination of two symbols, danger and opportunity. Risk is danger plus opportunity. It's the perfect way to think about risk. You know why? Because it locks them at the hip. It says, if you want one, you got to live with the other. Who amongst us doesn't want opportunity? We all want to make 80% returns, right? So if I ask you, how much danger are you willing to face? And you say, no, I don't like danger. You know what I'm going to tell you? Don't ask for 80% returns. Think of how many mistakes in investing and corporate finance would be avoided if we remembered this linkage. Because here's what happens. We get greedy, and then we get stupid in that sequence. Somebody says, you can make 30% with no risk. Part of you says, that can't be true. And the other part says, what if it is? And you let those two sides fight it out, the what if it is will win every single time. In fact, I'll give you a couple of examples of what happens when you forget this linkage. Anybody here from Orange County, California? Don't worry, are you from?
Close.
You're close, right? So where are you? 20 miles from Anaheim?
San Diego.
Okay. It's, you know, it's 60 miles, 16 hours by car if you have really bad traffic, but, you know, close enough. The reason I pick Orange County, California, it's one of the wealthiest counties. In fact, if you know, it's got Disneyland in it. How can it be a bad place to live? One of the wealthiest counties in the United States went bankrupt about 25 years ago. Why? Because the treasurer of the pension fund of the county decided to take a third of the money in the pension fund and bet on interest rates in Germany. I don't make up this stuff. So he takes a third of the money. He speculates on interest rates in Germany. And of course, he bets wrong, loses a third of the money. The pension fund declares. Huge story. And it's on 60 Minutes. And Mike Wallace, who used to be one of the doyens of 60 Minutes then, was doing the interview. And the treasurer of the county, his name was Robert Citrin. Citrin, Orange, get it? I think everybody in Southern California makes up a name. I think his real name must have been Robert Smith. And he said, you know what, it'll sound so much better if it sounded like I was from Orange County. So let's, I don't know what the real name was. So they're sitting across from each other, and Mike Wallace asks Robert Citrin, why would you take a third of pension fund money that's supposed to be invested in safe things and put it in all these risky things? And here's what Robert Citrin said. He said, Charlie Clough, it's because Charlie Clough told me I could make 15% with no risk, which your first response is, who the heck is Charlie Clough and why is he telling you these things, right? Charlie Clough used to be the market strategist for Merrill Lynch. In fact, that's the reason Merrill Lynch was a co-defendant on that lawsuit that came out of this crisis. Now, I don't know Charlie Clough, but I do know market strategists. Have you ever heard a market strategist talk? They're incredibly slippery creatures. They're incapable of making a definitive statement. After an hour of listening to a market strategy, you come out and say, what did he say again? I think he said stocks will go up. No, I think he said stocks will go down. No, I think he said stocks will be flat. No matter what happens, the strategist said, I told you so. Can you imagine the strategist says, you can make 50? Maybe, but let's assume that Charlie Clough did, in fact, in a moment of honesty or drunkenness or whatever it was, told Robert Citrin that he could make 15%. Back to the interview. Here's what Robert Citrin's saying. And I'm not a finance person. What's his job again? It's treasurer. I thought that was a financial, but I must be seriously mistaken. But let's step back. Do you have to be a finance person to know that if somebody walks up to you and says, you can make 15% with no risk, that they're lying? If you think you can make 15% with no risk, you probably also think that Rolex you bought on Canal Street for $45 last week is really a Rolex. You think, look, it says R-O-L-E-C-K-S. Hey, come on, for $45, the spelling doesn't always work out. Trust me, if you paid $45 for a Rolex, it's not a Rolex. If you pay $5 for a Mickey Mantle rookie card, it's not a Mickey Mantle rookie card. If you manage to get a Super Bowl ticket for $25, it's not a Super Bowl ticket. Maybe you can get it today. Even that would be difficult because it's probably in some collector's items. What I'm trying to say is sometimes people use the excuse that they're not financially sophisticated. That's why they're falling for this. But let's be honest. It's got nothing to do with financial sophistication and everything to do with being greedy. So keep that in mind. One of the things we're going to try to do in the next few pages, and this is the way to think about risk and return models in finance, is we're going to try to measure the danger in an investment. And there's nothing wrong by itself in being exposed to danger and asking, how much opportunity do I need to be okay with exposing myself to that danger? The way I describe this in finance, we're not bungee jumpers. We don't take on risk for the sake of taking on risk. We take on risk because we hope to get a higher expected return. So you ready? We're going to set this process up by looking at what we'd like a good risk and return model to contain. So these are the characteristics you would expect to see in a good risk and return model. So I'll list out my perfect model, then I'll show you the model that most people use, and let's see how close to perfection we get. So here's the first requirement. The risk and return model I use should come up with a measure of risk that applies to all assets. So in other words, you should be able to compare not just large stocks to small stocks, but stocks to bonds and U.S. stocks. So you want a risk measure that is universal. Otherwise, you'll have risk measures for each subset. How do you compare across the subsets? Second, You want that risk model to tell you what types of risks you're going to get rewarded for and what types of risk you will not get rewarded for. You say, why would I not get rewarded for risk I take? Let me give you an absurd example, and you can see why. Taking risk by itself is not going to entitle you to a reward. Let's assume you buy a house across a 6-lane highway from a brokerage house. And every morning, here's what you do. You get up, and you run across 6 lanes to get to the brokerage house. Very dangerous, right? Huge amounts of risk. At the end of every month, you said, I took a lot of risk this month. I could have been killed every single day. Where's my return? The market doesn't reward you for being stupid. So not all risk gets rewarded. And we're going to talk about what types of risk get rewarded and what doesn't. A good risk and return model should be able to separate the two. The third is when I give you the risk measure for a company, you should be able to look at that number, and by itself it should tell you whether this company is riskier than average or safer than average. I'll give you an example of a risk measure that's not, does not meet this requirement. If I told you that the standard deviation in IBM stock price is 35%, it's true, it's 35%. And I ask you, is it a risky stock? Why won't you be able to make a judgment? Because you don't know whether 35 is high, low, average. In other words, when I give you a standard deviation risk measure, it's just a number. Until I give you 15 other companies, you might not be able to use it to make a decision. So it'd be nice if I could give you a risk measure that you could look at and say, you know what, that's a high risk number. Fourth, that risk measure needs to be translated into an expected return. Remember, our end game is to come up with a hurdle rate. So whatever risk measure you come up with has to convert into an expected return. And finally, this model is, there's a very unpleasant requirement that every risk and return model in finance has to have. It has to work. So you ready? Let's go back to the very first risk and return model in finance. It is still the most widely used risk and return model in finance. It's called the capital asset pricing model, or the CAPM. You've seen it in foundations, probably in some very statistical variant. I'm not going to use a single statistical argument to make my case. I'm going to make it almost entirely in intuitive terms. So here's what the CAPM does. It starts off by defining risk as variance of actual returns or unexpected returns. So in other words, that brainwashing process starts right away. So let's think about risk as variance of actual returns around an expected return. So that's the first step. Second, it tells you that only that portion of the variance that you cannot diversify away, and we'll come back and talk about what exactly that means, will get rewarded. That the portion of the risk in an investment that you can eliminate by holding a portfolio, you're not going to get rewarded for. Third step, it converts that non-diversifiable risk measure into a number called a beta. And the nice thing about betas is they're standalone. In what sense? If I told you the beta for IBM is 0.95, what am I telling you about IBM? Less risky than the average stock, more risky around the... It's slightly less risky than the average stock because the beta across stocks is 1. So it's standalone. I can use the beta to come up with an expected return. The expected return investment is the risk-free rate, and we have to talk about that, plus a beta times a risk premium you demand for equities as a class, for the average risk investment. So it allows me to come up with a hurdle rate. And then I'm going to damn the model with faint praise, which is it works at least as well as every other model out there. Notice what I did not say. I didn't say it works really well. It works, you know, perfectly. It works at least as well as everything else. So what I'm going to try to do is take you through each step and talk about why we do what we do and the potential pitfalls of the assumptions we make along the way. So as we go along, gather along the assumptions I'm going to have to make to get to that end game of saying beta measures risk and gives me an expected return. So let's start with the first step in this process. In fact, the CAPM is part of a class of models that are called mean variance models. You think, what does that even mean? In the mean variance world, you as an investor look at only two dimensions on every investment. The first is, what's my expected return? The second is you ask, what's the variance in those returns? You think, as opposed to what, in a minute I'm going to give you a test and you're going to see what we're leaving out of the process. So if I give you two investments in the mean variance world, so hang in there. Let's suppose both have an expected return of 12%. And one has a standard deviation of 20%, the other has a standard deviation of 50%. it's a no-brainer. You're going to pick the one with the lower standard deviation because it's less risky for the same expected return. So the mean variance world, you make all your judgments based on what's the expected return, what's the variance. Do you guys live in a mean variance world? No idea what that is. In fact, that's a very abstract question. You say, I live in the world. I don't know whether it's a mean variance world or not a mean variance world. So let me put you to the test. If I looked at Disney, for instance, I can compute the standard deviation, the expected return. Over the between 2008 and 2013, the average annual return you'd have made in Disney over those 5 years would have been about 22%. So the stock did really well. And the standard deviation over that period was about 26%. By itself, you're saying, I don't know whether that's high or low, but it's a start in the process. That's how I judge Disney in the mean variance world. High expected return, no standard deviation of 26%. Now comes the test of whether you live in a mean variance world. Let's assume I come to you with two investments. Let's say they both have exactly the same expected return and exactly the same standard deviation. If I pause right there, in the mean variance world, these two investments would be equivalent. You'd be indifferent between the two. But I'm going to add one additional piece of information, and you tell me whether this might tilt your decision-making process. Let's assume that on investment day, there's this very small chance that you could quadruple your money. It's already embedded in the expected return, but there's a chance you could make a 400% return. On investment B, the best you can hope to make is a 60% return. So it's already captured in the expected return, the standard deviation. But on one of these investments, the best case scenario is you could quadruple your money. In the other one, your best case investment is that you can make only a 60% return. So you ready? I'm going to make you pick. Again, there's no right answer, so don't look at your neighbor. This is about your preferences. How many of you would still be indifferent between these two investments? So there you have the answer. How many people in this room live in a mean variance world? Either you're completely indifferent, or none of us lives in a mean variance world. Because if you lived in a mean variance world, you should have said, say, now let's dig a little deeper. How many would prefer investment A because of the 400% return? Don't worry, just put your hand up. There's no right answer, as I said. You know what? In finance, we say you prefer skewness. That's a fancy word. So in statistics, skewness refers to the fact that you have a long tail on your distribution. So you like skewness, which means you're willing to pay a higher price for something because it gives you this option of being. How many of you bought, remember when the Powerball tickets got up to what, 1.6 billion or whatever it was, some absurd amount? Be honest, how many of you actually who never bought lottery tickets felt inclined to stop and try? Okay, there you go. You know why, right? This is your only, I shouldn't say that because some of you might become billionaires on your own. This might be one of the few pathways to get to be a billionaire overnight. And you were willing to get an expected return. What's the expected return from buying a lottery ticket? You wish it was zero. In fact, in most states, a portion of the lottery money is claimed by the government for whatever. So it's actually an expected return of minus 30 or minus 40%. So in a mean variance world, none of us would ever buy lottery tickets. But we're not being irrational. We do it because we want that skewness. Why else would you walk into a casino? Even if you're a practice gambler, you know, in a casino, you already start off because the house has to claim, what, 5%, 7%, 10%. If it's a good casino, probably only 5%. You're still starting off with an expected return of minus 5%. So we like skewness, which also means that if you have a stock where there's a potential for making a lot of money, what does it say? You're willing to push the price up because you want that. Now do you see why some young growth companies might have a premium price? Is you're saying, this is my only chance to make 10-fold, 20-fold what I invested, so I'm willing to pay a premium, which means I'm settling for a lower expected return. Now let me ask you a follow-up question. What if I told you that in one of these investments, this goes back to the earlier definition of risk, in one of these investments there's a chance you could lose all of your money, and one of your investments the most you can lose is 60%. Might that affect your choice as well? I think so. I mean, there are people who say, look, minus 60% is, now if I bring both together, your choice becomes more difficult. They say, look, on the investment where you can quadruple your money, you're also likely to lose 100% sometimes. on the investment where you can make only a plus 60. Now you can see why investing becomes fuzzy once you get out of the mean variance world. So the first assumption the CAPM makes is we all live in a mean variance world, and I think we've just established that that assumption is patently unrealistic. But let's put it to the side. Unrealistic assumption, let's keep going. Second step in the process, we're going to look at that risk and say not all risk gets rewarded. So let me take again a company that we all can relate to. Let's take Disney. Okay? Think of all the risks you face when you invest in a Disney. The new Jungle Book movie is coming out. Have you heard? This is going to be not an animated version. It's going to have it's going to be $150 to $200 million big budget movie. Remember the Cinderella that they came out with did really well too, even though it was not an animated movie. So they have big plans. But is it possible that this could crash and burn? It could be another Lone Ranger, right? Remember Lone Ranger? Where you put Johnny Depp as the Lone Ranger? Let's face it, when I see Johnny Depp, I see a drunk pirate, no matter what he plays. Okay? I'm sorry, but this guy's been stereotyped in my head to the point, and he basically acts like a drunk pirate, no matter what role he has. And a Lone Ranger who acts like a drunk pirate doesn't quite have the resonance you'd expect him to have. And that movie, I think, Disney wrote off $170 million. So when you think about risk in Disney, the first risk is that when they invest in a new movie, that they could screw it up. They're also investing, I think, almost $500 million in Disneyland in Anaheim, building a new Star Wars themed section for the park. Is that a guaranteed moneymaker? In fact, they've had a lot of trouble in Disneyland getting people to cross that. Have you ever been in Disneyland? One side you have Magic Kingdom, and the other side you have California Adventure, which is there. So the California Adventure, the problem they've had is people who go to the Magic Kingdom don't always make it across, so they're getting only 40% of the people who go to into Magic Kingdom are coming to them. This is one of their ways of trying to get that to go up to 60 or 70%. Could it work? Yes. Could it fail? Sure. So when you think about the risk of that expansion, it's risk that'll affect you. You see, why do you pick those two investments? On those two investments, if Disney fails, only Disney gets affected by that failure. Right? Universal Studios is not going to lose 10% of its stock price if Disney overinvests in. So these are risks that affect just Disney. Let's move one step up the ladder. Let's pick on ESPN. ESPN's been a cash cow for Disney, right? Cash cow in what sense? How many of you have cable? Okay, that's already a problem for ESPN, that so few of you have cable. Because every cable bill, every month, that every person in the U.S. pays, $7 of that cable bill go to ESPN. Think about that. This is the ultimate cash cow. And for 10 years, it has been the cash cow that's allowed Disney to do a lot of stuff. The problem, though, in the last 2 years is people are cutting the cord with Hulu, Netflix. And the only thing that keeps cable afloat, the only thing between cable and the abyss is live sports. If you don't care for live sports, what the heck are you doing paying for cable? You can watch the Food Network why would you want to watch the Food Network in the first place? But you can watch it on cable without paying for cable. There are lots of different ways you can do it. So when you think about investing in Disney, you worry about the fact that ESPN's competition is coming from Hulu and Netflix taking away cable. That could affect Disney. It could affect pretty much every company in this entertainment space that draws from the cable cash cow. So it's not just Disney, maybe 10, 15, 20 other companies. Time Warner is going to be hurt as well. Your entire sector could be affected by something. Like what? I mean, one of the businesses that Disney is in collectively is the broadcasting business. Every time the FCC passes new rules, it affects everybody in the broadcasting space. It's risk that affects maybe 30, 40, 50 companies in the space. Do you see where I'm going? I started with risk that affected one company, went to risk that affected 10 or 12 companies. Now I'm at risk that affects maybe 50 companies. Last couple of years, if you've been watching exchange rates, the U.S. dollar has gotten stronger and stronger. It's been weak in the last week or so, but it's become. Now, do you think that affects Disney as a company? In good ways or bad ways? Bad ways, and why? It's actually their merchandising is not the big problem they face. One is the theme parks. When you think, if you've ever been to Orlando, at one point in time, half the people in line in front of you were Brazilian. Why? Because the real was really strong. So if you wanted a cheap vacation in Sao Paulo, you actually flew to Orlando. But still, today, with the real half what it was, this is like increasing prices 100%. So what does that do? It drops off the number of people coming to theme parks. So a stronger dollar could hurt Disney. But it's not just Disney, right? There are potentially hundreds of companies that are affected by the dollar strengthening or weakening. Now we're talking about risk that affects a lot of companies. And let's take one final step up the ladder. Have you ever seen Janet Yellen in front of Congress? Every 3 months, a Federal Reserve chair has to get up. Or when you, in fact, there you also have these news stories around every Federal Open Market Committee meeting, which is when the Fed gets together. And the news stories always talk about what, at least for the last few years, what's always the question that people seem to be asking? Will the Fed raise rates? I, for one, don't believe the Fed has the power to raise rates to begin with. Because what's the only rate the Fed controls? The Fed, in fact, about 6 months ago, I took my wife and two of my kids to, you know, they can do a tour of the Federal Reserve. You can go to that building that looks like a jail. Have you seen the building? It's this huge building with metal bars. But they actually have a neat tour. You go in and they take you. I almost made myself persona non grata because on the day we went in, this 23-year-old tour guide comes up and I almost asked her, could you take me to the interest rate room? You know the room I'm talking about? Because you listen to CNBC. The vision you get of Janet Yellen coming in every morning, going to the interest, I'll raise T-bond rates today. The mortgage rate is too low. I mean, that's a vision you get of her moving all these levers around. When the reality is the only rate the Fed controls is the Fed funds rate. So I almost asked her a follow-up question, which is, can you take me to the Fed window? I'd like to borrow at the Fed funds rate. I know what she'd have told me. It's not for you. It's only for banks. So the only rate the Fed controls, none of us ever get to see. But there are these visions of maybe the Fed affects rates. If you're interested in what I think about the Fed's power, you can read it on my blog. But to the extent that they can affect rates, let's say they can raise rates. Is Disney affected by higher interest rates? Absolutely. So is every other company on the face of the earth. Even companies not in the U.S. You see where we've gone? We've started with the risk in the Jungle Book, which was a risk that affected one company. We've gone all the way to risks that affect almost every company. You're saying, who cares? If you put all your money in Disney, which of these risks are you exposed to? All of them, right? Now, if you put some of your money in Disney and some of your money in 25 other companies, are you still exposed to all these risks? Yes, but here's what's going to happen. What's the risk you face in the Jungle Book that's the movie might do worse than expected? Or it could do better than expected. Remember, it can cut both ways. Let's say you have 25 companies. You invest in the Home Depot. The next new venture they have could do better or worse than expected. But in each of these companies, if you have investments that can cut both ways, you know what's going to happen as you spread your bets? It's called the law of large numbers. It's a statistical argument, not even an economic argument. Those risks that affect one or a few companies is going to average out across your portfolio. I'll tell you what form it takes. Okay? I own 53 companies, and I mentioned this, you know, earlier when we talked about not going to an annual meeting. Every day when I read the paper, it's like a roller coaster ride. Because on page one, there's a news about some company I own. It's good news. I say, this is good. Then I get to page three. There's news I read about another company. It's doing awful. It's so horrible. This is terrible. And by the time I get to the very last page, about 12 of my companies will be in the news. And if it's company specific, it's going to be cutting both ways, unless God has it out for you, in which case you're kind of doomed anyway. But company specific risk averages out. But if you have a day like today, you know the market's doing today? Not good things. It's down about 2%. I'm not even going to look at my portfolio this evening. I'm going to act like I have nothing in there. Because I know exactly what I'm going to find. I'm going to find that most of the stocks in my portfolio are down. Why? Because there's a market-wide risk kicking in. So spreading your bets is not going to protect you if the market's down 4%, but if you're talking about risks that are individual risks, those get averaged out. It's a very intuitive concept. You can show it statistically. You can show it with covariance and variance. But why do you need that? It's a very intuitive concept of saying, you spread your bets, risks that affect one or a few firms is going to get averaged out. So on any given day, even if you were owning LinkedIn last Friday and you were feeling awful about it, I just pray and hope that this was not the only thing you owned, in which case you should feel doubly awful about it because you just lost half your money. But if LinkedIn was one of 35 companies, you are going to feel a little uncomfortable about the fact that one of your 35 companies went down 48%. But you're not going to be bereft. It's not going to destroy your portfolio. So the argument for diversification doesn't have to be a statistical one. It's just the fact that intuitively, as you combine stocks, risks that affect one or a few firms will get averaged out across the portfolio. Any questions on that concept? Now I'm going to introduce the notion of a marginal investor. Before I do that, this argument for diversification is pretty intuitive, right? Everybody should get it. You know how many stocks a typical individual investor in the U.S. who invests in stocks? Many investors actually just invest in mutual funds, which is actually a sensible thing for most people to do. But among individual investors who invest in stocks, you know what the median number of stocks in their portfolio is? Three. So the typical individual investor doesn't either get this or thinks that they're special. So we have a problem. Most investors are not diversified. But we're going to introduce the notion of a marginal investor. Let me explain what a marginal investor is. You take a stock like Cisco, Coca-Cola. Thousands of people own shares in the company, right? Some might be like the individual that I described. They own three stocks, with Coca-Cola being one. Some might be stupid enough to have all their money in Coca-Cola. Some might have no choice but have all their money in Coca-Cola. You're saying, why? You're an employee of a company. You get paid in stock, and over time, your problem is you work for the company. Your wealth is tied up in the company. It might be just that you're... But not all investors are made equal. The marginal investor in a company is the investor most likely to affect prices on their next trade. Keyword is affect prices. Let me ask you a question. This is a little personal, but don't take it too personally. Do you think you affect prices when you trade? Let's say this after this class, you say, this is awful. I'm going to sell all 100 shares of my Apple stock. Don't expect the price to drop when you make that announcement. You could try it. Get on Yahoo Finance. I'm selling all 100 shares. So let's face it. You and I have zero chance of being marginal investors. To be marginal investors, you need to meet two conditions. One is, you need to own a lot of stock. How much is a lot? 1 million shares of Apple, 2 million shares, 5 million shares. And you need to trade those shares. Okay. We'll come back and talk about how to identify that marginal investor, but that's the marginal investor. You're saying, who cares? When you look at the hurdle rate for a company, the risk you should be building into that hurdle rate is not the risk you and I see in the company. It's what that marginal investor sees in the company. Why? Because they're the ones setting prices. They set the terms of the contract. And in corporate finance, we assume that that marginal investor is diversified. And I'll tell you, the easy way to defend that is, what types of investors do you think can afford to own 5 million shares of Apple and trade those shares all the time? It's probably going to be institutional investors, right? Maybe look at the top 17 investors in your company. It's going to be institutional investors. And if you're an institutional investor, for the most part, unless you're the Sequoia Fund and think you're special again, you're probably going to own 30, 40, 50, 80 companies in your portfolio. In which case, the assumption the marginal investor is diversified makes sense. We'll come back and talk about what if that's not true. But that's the assumption that you make. And here's how you can deal with the people. Say, what about a Facebook? Mark Zuckerberg is the biggest investor. Is he the marginal investor? Why isn't he? He owns a lot of shares, but what does he not do? He doesn't trade them because he wants control. He can't give up those shares. So even in a Facebook, the marginal investor is not going to be Zuckerberg. It's going to be the institutional investors below him because they're the ones who set prices at the margin. So when you think about looking for the marginal investor in your company, here are a couple of things you can look at. One is you can look at the percentage of stock in your company that's held by institutions. In the case of Disney, for instance, that number is about 75%. 75% of all the shares in Disney are held by institutions. And for Disney, it's going to be a no-brainer. Their marginal investor is going to be institutional because individuals don't even own enough shares to make a difference. If you have high institutional investment and high insider investment would be like a Zuckerberg or a Larry Page and a Sergey Brin. The fact that the insiders don't trade leaves the field open still to the institutions. So there too, I would say institutional investor with a little bit of the insiders affecting how institutions behave. If you have low institutional holdings and you have high insider holdings, it's really tough to tell. So if you have a small Midwestern company where the insider owns 31%, institutions own 5%, and individuals own the rest, you really can't tell whether that individual driving prices. Then we're on dangerous ground. We'll talk about what to do there. And if you have low institutional investment and you have high insider holding where a wealthy individual investor holds it, that wealthy individual investor might end up becoming the marginal investor. And you've got to hope and pray that that investor owns more than just this company. I'll give you an example of a wealthy individual who can own. Paul Allen. You know who he is? He co-founded Microsoft with Bill Gates. And, of course, he split off in the mid-'80s, became wealthy on his own. He actually owns a piece of the Portland Trailblazers. And he invests in companies, but he invests in dozens of companies. So he's actually a big, wealthy individual investor, but he's very similar to an institutional investor in the way that he spreads his wealth. So you're okay there. But if that wealthy individual has all of his or her money in this company, then again, we're talking about the danger zone. And again, we'll talk about what to do there. Essentially, what you're looking for is, in my company, how close am I to this ideal that risk and return models assume of the marginal investor being diversified? The closer you get, the safer you are using any of the risk and return models in finance. So let's see if we're safe with making this assumption at Disney. If you look at the top 17 investors in Disney, remember I showed you the 2003? There was nobody there who was an individual other than Roy Disney with 0.5%. Then I showed you 2009 and you saw Steve Jobs show up as the biggest investor. This is 2013. There's Laureen Jobs, as the widow of Steve Jobs. She got the 7% plus. But there's George Lucas. No wonder he had those complaints about white slavers. The $4 billion he got wasn't enough, I guess. But he owned 2%. Did you read about that? After the Star Wars episode came out, he got really pissed off at Disney and accused them of being white slavers. Yeah. They're one of the largest stockholders in the company. Right? It's kind of tough to go around throwing those terms around. So if you look at 2013, it's true you have two big individual investors, George Lucas and Laureen Powell Jobs, but neither is a marginal investor because neither trades. So you look at the rest, all institutional investors. In Disney, I feel perfectly comfortable making the assumption marginal investors diversify. Now, if you look at the other companies I have, let's see how close I can get. With Disney, it's a slam dunk. Institutional investor, marginal investor, well diversified. With Deutsche, you do have a lot more individual investors who hold the stock, many of whom never trade. So these are Germans who put Deutsche into their portfolio, and forgot about it 10 years ago, 11 years ago, 15 years ago. That 41% institutional investing accounts for about 75% of the trading in Deutsche. So in Deutsche, I'm a little more stretched than I was with Disney, but I feel okay assuming the marginal investors diversified. With Vale, with the preferred shares, the non-traded shares, 71% is held by institutions. I'm sorry, the traded shares, non-voting shares. Okay. The voting shares never get traded. Those six entities kind of hold on to the shares. In the case of Vale, the share price is being set almost entirely by the preferred shareholders because they're the only ones who trade, and that's institutional. Tata Motors does have a breakdown, but those insider holdings are really the other Tata companies that own shares in Tata Motors, and they never trade. And here again, I looked at the percentage of trading that came from the institutions. With Tata Motors, about 80% of the trading comes from institutional investors, and about a third of that trading comes from foreign institutional investors. You're saying, who cares? If your marginal investor becomes a foreign institutional investor, it can change the perception of risk that they bring to the game, in good ways or bad ways. So we'll talk about how that plays out when we talk about the risk. And with Baidu, 70% is institutional. So with my five companies, I am going to be on pretty safe ground assuming that the marginal investor is well diversified. What's my sixth company? bookstore, right? And it's a privately owned bookstore. You see the problem I'm going to face there? Assuming the owner of that privately owned bookstore is diversified would be beyond absurd. Why? Because you own a private business, guess what? All your money is tied up in that business and you have no chance to get diversified. So we're going to talk about what am I going to do there, and you're going to see the template that I'm going to give you if your company ends up being one of those companies that does not have a marginal investor who's diversified. So at this stage, here's where we are. We've defined risk in terms of variance. We've said only that portion of the variance that you cannot diversify away gets rewarded. Why? Because a marginal investor is a diversified investor. Here's the third step in the process. I said I had 53 stocks in my portfolio, right? And we've already talked about the intuitive rationale for diversifying, that adding an extra stock will effectively spread your risks out more. So adding the 11th stock will make your portfolio less risky than 10 stocks. Adding the 21st will make it less risky than the 20th. Adding the 51st stock will make it less risky than the 50th. It's true the marginal benefits will get smaller and smaller as you keep adding additional stocks, but it'll always be positive. So I have a question, and you can give me the cruel answer first and the more thoughtful answer next. Why did I stop at 53 stocks? Give me the cruel answer first. Because you don't have enough money. Okay, we got that out of the way, which is actually true. But Fidelity Magellan has $150 billion to invest, and they have only 150 stocks in their portfolio. So why did they stop? There are two reasons why people stop. I want to see if you can identify one or both. No, you always will get a benefit. It's always going to be positive. Just get smaller and smaller and smaller. It'll never get below zero. It'll never get to zero. The 10,555th stock you add will still make your portfolio less risky. It's just going to be a really small benefit, but it's always going to be positive.
It's too costly to manage.
Okay, so first we're introducing a cost. You're introducing a man, but before you even get to the management cost, there has to be a. There's another cost. There's a trading cost. There's a transaction cost, and there might be a monitoring cost and a managing cost. So the first reason we stop is there's a cost to adding that extra stock. And the costs exceed the benefits, you're going to stop there. What's the second reason we stop? Let me ask you a question. How many of you would like to be average investors? Go to a cocktail party and say, I'm an average investor. See how many people gather around you for anecdotes. Let's face it, we all want to beat the market, right? Do you see where I'm going next? The second reason we stop is because we think we can pick the best stocks. Whether that's true or not, that's why we stop. So the two reasons we stop are collectively this transaction monitoring trading cost, and the second is we think we can pick the right stocks. Remember the CAPM? We start off assuming we're in the mean variance world. Here are the next two assumptions. In the CAPM, there are no transactions costs. And there's no private information, which is a euphemism for you cannot pick winners and losers. So if you have no transactions costs and you cannot pick winners and losers, when should you stop diversifying? What have I just done? I've taken away the two reasons for stopping, right? So you won't stop at 51, you won't stop at 501, you won't stop at 5001. You won't even stop at 42,000, every traded stock. You will buy every traded bond. In fact, you won't stop till you have a small piece of every single traded asset in the world in your portfolio. You're saying, that is absurd. But that's where you're going to end up in this world, right? Let's call this a gigantic mutual fund, an index fund. You know what index funds are, right? The Vanguard 500 index fund is going to replicate the S&P 500. Think of this as a gigantic index fund with an 800 number. So if you're an investor, here's all you need to do. You have two phone numbers in front of you. One is a phone number for a treasury fund where you can invest in something risk-free. The other is a phone number for this gigantic index fund, which includes every risky asset. And all you have to do is decide how much you're going to put in each one. So let's make this specific. Let's assume he likes to take no risk at all. I'm not making any value judgments here. Let's say you don't want to take any risk. Which phone number are you going to call? You have two numbers, treasury number, and the other is this gigantic index fund with every risky stock. You want to take no risk. You're just going to call the treasury number and say, I want to put all my money in the treasury fund. So he's done. 100% in the risk-free asset. He wants to take some risk. So you call the first number, you put half your money in the treasury fund, half in the gigantic index fund. He wants to take even more risk. He calls just the index fund. He puts all his money in the index fund. But she wants to take even more risk. So in this world that I've described, how do you get to take more risk than him? He has already invested. So what do you have to do to take risk? You will borrow money, and guess what you'll do? You'll buy exactly the same. The most efficient way to take risk in this world is not buy the riskiest stocks, but actually buy the same fund, but use leverage or borrowing to kind of take your risk. So at the end of this game, if you go around this room, if this were the entire CAPM world, the only two things in each of our portfolios is going to be a risk-free investment and this gigantic mutual fund that includes every traded asset in the market. Let's be creative and call it the market portfolio. Okay, kind of makes sense. You make that leap, you've effectively got to the CAPM. Because if each of us owns this gigantic index fund, when we look at an individual stock, guess how we measure risk? We measure risk as the risk added on, the risk added on to what you already have. So when I say, how risky is Disney to you? You don't think about Disney's risk standing alone. You think about the risk it adds to the market portfolio. That's it. That's the intuition. Of course, we have to wrestle with how do I measure that risk? And statistically, it's going to be captured by how Disney moves with the rest of the market. If Disney doesn't move at all, the rest of the market, guess what? It'll add no risk to your portfolio because it'll just move completely in a different way than the rest of the market. So when we use statistically what we use to capture how Disney moves in the market is called the covariance. Don't get overwhelmed by statistics. Basically, covariance measures how does the stock move with the market. And once I get there, I'm almost home. Because that covariance, I'm going to divide by the variance of the entire market for every single stock. And why am I doing that? Because it allows me to end up with a standardized number called beta. The next time you use beta, think of the baggage you have to carry with you. You have to assume that you're in the mean variance world. You have to assume there are no transactions costs. You have to assume that there's no private information. And if you're willing to make all those assumptions, then the risk of a stock can be measured with its beta. And once you measure that risk with the beta, you can get the expected return with that beta. So go through the steps we went through because each one is central to understanding modern finance. This is the foundation for almost everything we do in risk and return in finance. And it's amazing how people, even with MBAs and PhDs, have a very, very loose grasp of what exactly they're doing. Next time you're running to an investment banker who uses beta all the time, ask him what he's assuming. He said, what? That the Bloomberg machine works. Look, it gave me a beta. Because that's what it becomes. It becomes a number you plug into your. Don't let it become that number. So I use the CAPM still when I do valuation. So when I go into a company, sometimes I'll value the company. And there'll be always somebody who brings up issues with the CAPM. I mean, the less they know, the more dangerous they become. So I'm going to give you some ammunition, because if you use the CAPM, you're going to run into some of these critiques. I'm going to give you some ammunition to meet these critiques. The first critique I hear is that the model makes unrealistic assumptions. Does it? Of course. No transactions cost, no private information, mean variance. You know what? That critique has never bothered me. You know why? Because I used to be an econ major in a previous lifetime. I let that go very quickly. And some of you might remember these realistic models in economics. You know the ones I'm talking about? Where if you can observe the second derivative of the utility function to wealth, everything's going to be clear to you. I remember putting up my hand during that class and saying, how do I get to observe this? And I remember the instructor saying, nobody's done it yet. But once you do it, everything's going to be clear. I said, that's good. Given a choice between a model that makes realistic assumptions that nobody can use, which is what that second derivative of the utility function model is, and making unrealistic assumptions and ending up with a model that I can use, I know which way I'm going to go every single time. So that I can deal with. The second critique will come from the coward in the last row. Put up his hand. What if you made a mistake? But what, your beta could be wrong. To which my response is, I think that's all I got wrong. You should see my earnings, my cash flows, my margins, my revenues. They're all wrong. Why? Because they're all in the future. If I have to make estimates of the future, I'm going to be wrong. If your criteria for using a model is show me that it works perfectly every single time, no model is going to pass the test. Which brings me to my third critique, and this is where I think we get into trouble. Remember I said the model has to work? If the CAPM is right, it should explain 100% of the variation in returns across stocks over very long periods. In other words, if I took 30 years of returns and I took betas for each of these investments, since beta is the only thing that matters, it should explain 100% of the variation. You know what it actually explains? 8%. And now we're on scary ground. When we're using a model that doesn't explain 92% of what's going on, and then you're nailed, right? You say, well, what the hell are you doing using a model that doesn't explain 92% of what's going on? I'm going to give you an anecdote you can use. The advantage of anecdotes is by the time you're done, people will forget the question they asked, and you can move on. So when somebody says, how come you're using this model that explains only 8%? I tell them about these two guys who go camping. Late at night, they're sitting around a campfire, mellow time. They hear the sound of a crazed grizzly coming at them through the forest, killing everything in its path. So one of the campers zips up his sleeping bag, gets ready to die. I don't know what form this takes. I'm sorry I did that bad deal, never again. The other guy starts jogging in place, warming up. The guy in the sleeping bag says, what are you doing? He says, I'm going to run. And the sleeping bag says, look, you can't outrun a grizzly. They run 55, 60 miles an hour when they're crazed. And the guy in the sleeping bag says, look, I don't have to outrun the grizzly. All I have to do is outrun you. Just remember that. It's a morbid thought, but it kind of captures what's going on. You say, what's this got to do with the CAPM? It's true, the CAPM is an awful model. But remember what Milton Friedman once said about models? It takes a model to beat a model. It's a crappy model, but they're all crappy. So you can come up with an alternative model, but they all have trouble. I think part of the reason the 8% is so low is because people do a really crappy job estimating betas. I think I can push that up to maybe 20, 25%. But I'm okay with that. You know why? There are 66 million people walking around thinking Elvis is still alive, right? So don't go around building models that are somehow going to capture this. So I'm going to leave you with the alternatives to the CAPM because, in a sense, this is what people will do. Okay? So in the CAPM, we measure market risk with a beta. And until 1978, it was the only game in town. 1978, a guy called Steve Ross said, why are we capturing all this risk in one beta? Why can't we allow for multiple betas and multiple market risk factors? People said, that's nice, but how will we ever know how many factors there are and what the betas are? He said, don't worry, just give me a powerful computer and lots of raw data. And they did. Remember how I defined market risk? It affects most or all companies at the same time, right? So he sent the computer on a search mission. He said, go find patterns in the data where a lot of companies move together. It's called a factor analysis. And when you do a factor analysis, what you get as output is twofold. You get the number of factors or patterns the computer found in the data and the beta for every company against every factor. When you do that, you've gone from the CAPM to what's called an arbitrage pricing model. The arbitrage pricing model allows for multiple market risk factors and a beta against each one. It's got one very big weakness. Know what it is? It's five factors. You know what the names of the factors are? Factor 1, factor 2, factor 3, factor 4, factor 5. It's a statistical model. Can you imagine trying to sell a client on using this model? Your cost of equity is really high, and they ask you why, and say, you're very sensitive to the second factor. And they say, what that is? What is that? I said, don't know what it is, but be very careful when it's around. It's not going to fly. The arbitrage pricing model never took off. And while you're thinking about why it didn't take off is when I asked you what the second factor was, you couldn't give me a name, right? So you could see what the next phase in this process was. People started attaching names to factors. Not randomly, that would be unethical, but actually based on statistics and mathematics. They said, this looks like interest rates, this looks like the... And when you put macroeconomic names on these factors, you've gone from an arbitrage pricing model to what's generically called a multi-factor model. You think, this is good, why don't we use those? Those models are really good at explaining the past because you've picked the right factors, but they're awful at predicting the future. So when we start on, what day are we in? When we start on Wednesday, we will complete this process of looking at risk and return models. But then we're going to start doing concrete things like estimating risk-free rate. So I will see you on Monday. I'm sorry, Wednesday. I want to tell you.
asked about selection of the companies. So we wanted to go with consumer discretionary, and the companies that we went with seem pretty different. I don't know if that would affect our work.
That's fine.
So it's Fitbit, Toyota, and Netflix.
Does Fitbit make money?
Check. I'm not sure.
No, check with that. If they're not making money, don't pick them.
Okay. Yeah. But other than that, that shouldn't cause any problem long term. Okay. Thank you.
As long as they make money, you're okay. Walk up with me because I have to catch a train today. I'm pretty.
Yeah. When our group chose foods as our theme, General Mills, Kellogg's, Starbucks.
You can even throw in a Shake Shack. You want to talk to me? Sorry, did he?
I'll just join you.